Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Legacy Leaders Radio.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Jack Perry at Legacy Leader Radio here in Midtown Atlanta. It's kind of a mixed bag of emotions for me today. This will be my last Legacy Leader Radio show. I think I'll be in hiatus for a while. And before we start off today, today's show, I'd like to, first of all, thank some great people who have come into my life in the last 6 months while I've been doing this show, who have been supporting me, loving me, and helping me and getting me on my way. And I want to thank Brother John, who's out in Palm Springs right now, who's listening, and now he's going, my doggone it, he mentioned my name. So, but John, you know who you are, and I want to say thank you very much. I also want to thank Tracy, who's been a big love and support for me down in Tampa, Florida, who's been my coach, and she knows who she is, and everybody else has been following for the last 6 months. I also would like to thank Brother Mike, who has been sharing the studio with me and sharing the microphone and bantering back and forth and keeping those silent moments in check with me and looking at me and throwing things when things didn't go right here in the studio. But it's okay. It's been good. And Mike,
it's been a mutual pleasure, Jack. It's just been quite a ride. It's sad it's ending, but we're ending on a high note, and I'm happy about that.
Yeah, I am. And a lot has come out of this show. I've met some wonderful, wonderful people, some great guests, everything from, gosh, from Chick-fil-A, Mark Miller, to the Wounded Warriors, to, come on, give me some more.
Luke Iorio was great.
Luke Iorio.
Street Grace. I mean, we've just had
Street Grace
week after week, man.
Cheryl DeLuca Johnson's been on the show. We've had, wonderful. And if I forget anybody, please forgive me, but they can always find me again on iTunes and also my website at sourcepointcoaching.com. And, also, I cannot continue without saying thank you to my mom, and I know she's listening right now, and she's been a big inspiration and one of my heroes, it's been a good ride. It's not quite over yet because we've got a great show today, and not only that, but I got some great things happening in my life, and the book's coming out. And in fact, I've got a copy of it here in the studio. And the editing copy, and then 1 August it'll be out on the net. My life won't be the same, and people are going to go, "Oh my gosh, is that you?
You the little kid on the front?"
Yeah, I am. Yeah. I am the little
not
kid.
Not so on, little anymore.
Yeah,
I can't see you. How tall are you? You 7 feet?
Yeah, the little kid on the front. He always looks so sad. He's a great kid. He's trying to be a pretty good kid, I think. And so we might as well get on with our show, and we have a wonderful, wonderful guest. And before I let him speak or introduce himself, and I'd like to tell you about Barry Hall, and Dr. Barry Hall. And I met Dr. Hall, several years ago when I was in a transformation in my life. And Barry's one of the first people I met. And he was my practicing doctor at the time, and Barry gave me a lot of direction, a lot of insight, and a lot of uplifting. And so that was actually one of the beginnings for me. And so I think it's very fitting and very honorable to have Barry on the show today as the last show that I'm have. So Barry, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you for having me. Yeah. I'm honored.
Barry, tell us, let me just set this up real quick for the audience. Barry, medical doctor and mental health expert.
Sure.
Okay.
Let's go with that.
Mental health expert. Was it about 2 years ago that you changed it?
Yeah. It became official, formal, the primary thing. Just under 2 years ago.
Okay. Under 2 years ago, Barry started a new transformation in his life and started a new practice in Fayetteville, Georgia.
Right.
And has been very, very successful. And Barry has a unique approach. He has some great people that work with him. And Barry, just real quick, tell us how it's going and what's going on and what makes you so unique.
Well, it's going well. Mm-hmm. I think it's unique only because I don't know more than a couple other people in the country that have done something similar. Not that it's that special. I think it's just more unusual. I am a family physician by training, and I am still a family physician.
Mm-hmm.
And I got interested in mental health management, particularly from a diagnostic and a medication perspective initially, but more broadly in the overall care of mental health issues. And I hate to call them disorders because most of us that experience mental health episodes or things or whatever you want to call them, it's all within the context of their normal life.
Yeah.
Not everybody, but most. So anyway, I got interested in that. Did a form of training in that through a place called the Neuroscience Education Institute, an awesome guy who runs that, Stephen Stahl, just one of my heroes in psychiatry, and became certified through them as what's called a master psychopharmacologist, which, again, what a grandiose name or title.
Say that real fast.
Yeah, several times.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, but throughout the process, lots of, you know, mental health issues really start in the primary care office. So I'd find myself, you know, managing those, working through those, developing those. And it became such a large part of what I do that speaking with some of my colleagues at the counseling center component of where I am, they started encouraging me to, you know, you might want to do this more as your primary thing you're doing. And so finally that latched on a couple of years ago, and I decided to do that. And so now what I do primarily is mental health medicine. You can call it psychiatry, but technically I'm not a psychiatrist, so I like to be careful about that. And then I do some family medicine still as well. And that's what I do in my practice, and I love doing it.
What makes your approach so unique? And you said it's a unique approach. Here's what I'm going to get at. I'm going to get at what your approach is and the mental health aspects, their issues and concerns, especially in our neck of the woods, and what you can see and what you notice, and life-work balance, and how that's affecting us as a society. Would that be a good place to go?
Sure. How I approach it uniquely in some manner is a little hard to say, because I don't sit in the office of other, you know, psychiatrists or people practicing psychiatric medicine can say, well, here's how they do it.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's more the idea that, you know, in the medical field, not very often does somebody stray outside of what is officially their board certification area and practice that type of medicine. But, you know, but some do. After 20 years of practice and doing that kind of thing, I mean, experience is huge in what you do.
Yeah.
And also knowing what you don't know,
is
important. And you have to have the experience and the wisdom, perhaps, of experience and age to be able to say, you know, this is something I don't know. So I guess that what's unique is approaching mental health as a family medicine physician, as opposed to approaching mental health strictly as a psychiatrist. And that's not to say that it's better or worse. It's just a little bit different. And I think it might create some differences in my thought process, perhaps. I don't know that for sure. I think what you know, and I don't, and again, I don't know how much this, what's unique, is it's more just the passion for it, loving doing it. And so that does get into the whole life work balance, because just the other day at a meeting with my partners in the overall organization, out of the blue, one of them says, okay, so when are you going to retire? You know, when's everybody going to retire? You know,
I hate that. I don't like that question, but yeah, go ahead.
I don't mind the question. I mean, you know, the answer, well, I said definitely not before 70. My mom's 79. She just retired, and only after we badgered her incessantly to do so.
Right.
So I think I would be bored retired, and I think I feel like it'd be wasteful to be retired. Not, I mean, for myself, I enjoy what I do and love what I do, and I don't see stopping doing it as long as I make the effort to continue being knowledgeable about what I'm doing.
Yeah. Well, Barry, let me ask you this. May I call you Barry or Dr. Hall? What would you prefer?
Go with Barry.
Okay, go with Barry. Thank you. What does passion look like to you?
It looks to me like motivation on steroids.
Okay.
So, you know,
I like that.
You love what you do.
I dig that.
And you learn more than what you have to learn. You just keep learning more.
Yeah.
You know, maybe even stuff that you don't, that isn't pertinent, but it's related. So you keep wanting to learn. You want to learn more. You want to, not that you want to do more, you know, but you just want to learn more to make what you do, that you're able to do it better. You want to avoid being, what is it? The Peter principle. You know, aspiring to your own level of incompetence.
Yeah,
I want to make sure I never get to that level.
Right.
and, so make sure I try to know more than what I need to.
Yeah, we've dealt with folks like, so, yeah.
Yeah, we've been there.
We've been there. Yeah, we've been there. I want to touch on passion and stay with that for just a minute or so, because that's one of the things that I've discovered within myself, and it's a wake-up call for me. And sometimes you don't know what's going to happen. Sometimes the passion hits you upside the head like a baseball bat, and all of a sudden you realize, man, this is some really cool stuff I'm doing. I like this. In my world, passion is when you get up in the morning and you're glad to put your feet on the floor to go do what the hell it is you're going to go do, and you get the energy from it because you know you're either making somebody's life better, or you're creating something that's positive. You're creating something that, you know, maybe what I've gone through can help somebody else to be better for in their life. And without giving any of my stuff away here, when somebody tells you, Barry, you can't do that, may I ask how you'd respond to that?
Usually not well. and I don't mean in an inflammatory or angry sort of way.
Bring it, whatever.
Probably more in a frustrated, I need to go to somebody else sort of way to deal with it. I mean, there are things you can't do, but usually if I'm bringing something up, it's not because you can't do it. It's because you need to think of how to do it. I like putting, as I told you before, my specialty is putting square pegs in round holes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, let's not say we can't do something. Let's figure out how to do it. There's a book called Illusions by Richard Bach. He's the guy who wrote Jonathan Livingston Seagull. My age has heard of. And Illusions is a really interesting book. And there's one of my mantras I live by, and it says, argue for your limitations and they are yours.
Argue for your limitations and they are yours. Okay, I'm with it. I'm tracking with
you. So dissect that for the less competent folks.
for our layman, would you?
if you think you can't do something, then you can't. And the corollary is, if you think something can be done or you can do something, then you probably can.
What about, and this is one of the things that I fight personally, and when you loop and you go and you're to me, passion is when you start stepping out of your comfort zone and you go, man, I got to do this. But your little voice goes, no, you can't. And you go, oh, yes, I can. And you start to loop. You say,
oh, what do I say to somebody who tells me I don't think I can do that?
Yeah.
You know, I just don't think there's too many people who can't. If you think about it, you can probably do it.
Yeah,
it's just deciding to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's you know, compartmentalizing. Well, I'm just going to do it, and then do it.
Then do it.
Yeah, I think it's sort of like meditation. I only half know how to do it. I know how. Every now and then, I can get into that meditated zone or whatever it is where you empty your brain.
And
if you said, "Well, how do you do that?" Oh, I'm so sorry, Jack. I cannot tell you that one because I don't know. So you know, how do I tell somebody? You have to have, I guess, confidence. But more, it's just the doing will create the confidence, won't it?
You build it, and you build it, and you build it, and you build it. Yeah.
But I have asked patients to get that mirror marker. You know those markers you can write on your mirror.
Yeah.
And write, argue for your limitations and they are yours. And they'll see it every day looking in that mirror, and maybe it'll spark something in them over time.
So when did you recognize your passion?
Well, two different times. And both of them were at those lectures that sometimes pharmaceutical companies put on and then we go to, and then you hear negative things about them in the news. But the reality is most of us that go to those to learn something from other people like ourselves.
Yeah.
And so... one of them was from a guy named Tom Dayspring. He's out from New Jersey. He's a lipidologist. And I went to a lecture of his, and I was, I mean, it was light bulb bowled over, that kind of thing. And that's when I just decided I'm going to learn everything about this I can. Read everything, go to everything. And
You're addicted to the knowledge at that point. You were just trying to get more, right?
Yeah, but not just addicted to the knowledge, but applying it for the patients. And then the same with psychiatry. A gentleman, Dr. Pradko from Michigan, mm-hmm. who's a family physician that basically practices psychiatry is a huge part of what he does. Yeah. And he came and I listened to him, and it was another light bulb moment for that. And so I just started down those paths, and they evolved into things I wouldn't have predicted they would evolve into, but they did. And that's great.
When you discovered your passion and let me just back up. Why do most people, I think, some people live a life of quiet desperation, wanting to find their passion, okay? And some of the people I work with, and that's a very common question I get, is I don't know what my passion is. I don't know what that looks like. What would you say, what would you recommend? What techniques or skill that you would use to say, okay, here's a way that you can start to search to find what your passion is and what your meaning and purpose in life is?
All right. So I may not be the right person to ask.
I know it's a loaded one.
But when you're asked, I think the answer, I'm not sure you go search for a passion. I think you stumble upon it.
Mm.
So, you know, what you do is you live life. Doing what you do, I guess, professionally, vocationally, you know, to move forward, but then with other people as well, that part of living life, and you're going to bump into it. When you least expect it, not what you thought it'd be. I was thinking about what's the most difficult thing I encounter, I think, in my practice. And it's young people that lack motivation.
Ooh, talk to me.
And it's not one of those things that's maddening. It is frustrating. What it is, though, is it's one of the truly saddest things that I think I see, because we all struggle with trying to treat low motivation in young people. The therapists, struggle with it from a medication perspective. I struggle with it because, there's nothing that's, FDA approved for motivation. And we do have ideas of things that can help with some people, and sometimes they help some. But, it's sad because you see a life with the potential for waste.
Why do you think that's such an issue nowadays? Or is you just more aware of it, maybe?
And it might be that. It might be that. I do think that one of the biggest troubles we deal with societally these days is technology. Isn't this really kind of the children that are the age of mine, 17 and 21? These are the ones that are the first generation to grow up with technology as a part of their lives. And that wasn't, that's not what we had. And we see young people constantly with, and adults with, screen addictions, we call it, or media addictions. And boy, oh boy, I think that really sucks the life out of people. And that ability to learn to just, know what you need to know about it, but put that stuff away.
What about social skills?
It does seem to compromise that quite a bit. People who have no in-person social skills, but they're dynamos over the things that you play interactively with other people on the internet and the related social media to that.
Mm-hmm. Parents, how would a parent, like the Generation Xers, and then the Millennials, and that's their thing. I was driving down the street today, and it's interesting. I'm a creature of observance, and when I stop at a stop sign or an intersection, all the people it's an addiction. When they get to stops, they have to look and see who's tweeted them, who's got them on the phone, who's texted them while they're driving, and they only probably drove from one stoplight a half a mile down a road to another stoplight, and then they have to go look, and so we lose that. I see that with people that get addicted to their technology, and they don't know how to open a door for an adult, or don't know how to open a door for somebody else, don't know how to say thank you, or they, because they want to get to that next tweet or that next message. That's a very good. That's a very good correlation. The motivation. So, how do you treat it?
Well, when I think that that the technology is a big part of it, I encourage parents and patient himself to go on a zero technology period of time.
No, I can't take my cell phone away from my child, because then if I take my cell phone away from my child, that Barry, that means I have to interact with my child. That means I've got to sit down and have a meaningful conversation, Barry. What's up with that?
Are you saying that we parents are part of the problem?
Oh, my gosh. Uh-huh.
I call that the lifeguard effect. I used to be a lifeguard, and parents would drop their kids off and then go read a book, and now it's my problem. It's the lifeguard effect. They babysit their kids with whatever they can.
But, maybe that's a good thing. You know, maybe there's not enough of parents turning kids over to do something relatively independently.
Yeah,
you
know, okay.
The parents are you know, it's play date. Did you have a play date? You know,
I don't think I ever
had a play date. I played constantly, but I didn't have a play date.
I didn't have a play date.
Not unless I asked to play with someone who lived in another subdivision or something like that. And then, yeah, but normally it was just we went outside and played.
Yeah, well, when I grew up, it was like I was talking to a friend of mine about this yesterday. It's that my parents, especially in summertime, it's go play, and when the streetlights come on, it's dark. That's when you better come in the house and come eat dinner.
Yeah, or the old dinner bell.
Yeah, the dinner bell.
We had a dinner bell.
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't hear it.
Exactly.
Sorry, Mom. I didn't. And you could play as long as you didn't get in trouble, you know. And then parents were attuned to your screams or hollering, and they knew where your child was. And if somebody said, "Hey, where's my son?" Well, we saw him walking down the street, and you know, it was okay. And we didn't go hover around. And I had a friend of mine. And I was presenting for another agency, and the guy, we were talking about technology, and he had his daughters said, "I want to have a sleepover, a slumber party," and the dad said, "Sure, no problem." So he comes home, and he's home with the kids and everything, and he knows there's like six girls upstairs in the bedroom. Well, when you get six young girls together, usually there's noise and stuff happening, you know, things are going on and everything, and people talking and gabbing, but there was quiet. Very eerie quiet. So he goes up the stairs, and he's, you know, making noise and everything, and he gets to the door, and he knocks and he opens the door, and they're all sitting around the room on their cell phones texting each other. They're not talking, they're just texting each other email. And he goes, "You got to be kidding me. This is a slumber party? You know, this is, you know?"
Yeah. Yeah, you look at the Braves game now, and you see the shots of the crowd, and you know, the young girls and the kids, they're not looking at the game. They're looking at their phone, but they're at a game. Like, how weird is that?
A game, yeah. And then, or the person at church.
Yeah.
That does it at church. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
It's crazy.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
So, you know, how the
I'm
question
sorry,
I...
Yeah.
Well, the question I have about that is a good friend of mine, you probably know Steve Plunkett. He's one of my life heroes.
Uh-huh.
He will share with me things that he reads and things. And he said years ago, he told me that he was reading this something. And on average, women have 25,000 words a day in their mouth to speak, and men have 12,000. So that's maybe the idea of why... Men may come home at the end of the day. They've spoken their 12,000, and they're not real chatty.
I hit my quota.
Chatty.
Now leave me alone.
Hit my quota.
So, what are these young girls doing with their 25,000 words that they still have to speak if they've been texting everything?
Yeah, it's good point. Good point. And, ladies and gentlemen, that was Dr. Barry Hall. That was, you know.
Yes, that wasn't Jack.
Yeah, it wasn't.
You don't know Jack.
Yeah, you don't. Yeah. Oh, trust me, it is a friend of mine has a T-shirt. Just points and says, "You don't know Jack." And I said, "Okay, thanks."
Appreciate it.
Barry, let's, on a serious note, mental health and anger and anxiety in our society today. Do you come across that?
Constantly?
Okay.
A lot.
Let's talk about anger and the effects it has that you have seen in your expertise on how it affects our society and the interactions with people that can either, the physiological effects, which is an MD you may deal with, and then also the mental health aspects of it and how they may correlate, the anger and the effect it has on the body and how people may view and see their day and see themselves.
Well, you know, most of the time, anger is a part of a mood disorder. And mood disorder, when we use it medically, is sort of a wastebasket term for affective issues, which could be anxiety or depression or bipolar or things related to that. So that's the affective mood disorder arena. And the anger doesn't generally appear as a diagnostic criteria for those entities I've mentioned. So really the anger might be a reflection of a depressive symptom or of impulsivity or anxiety, or more typically a mixture of those things. But in the adolescent, it's more apt to be a uniform appearance of a mood disorder than in an adult. And what another one of my heroes in psychiatry, Dr. Charles Raison, Chuck Raison, who used to be at Emory and is in a unique research group in Tucson now. And some of the things that his group and others have been studying is the relationship between mood disorders and inflammation. Mm-hmm. It's interesting how inflammation and the gut and the gut microbiome are perhaps at the root of, but certainly related to, so many things in medicine. Cardiovascular disease, number one killer in the country and eventually the world, but as well as mental health disorders, and particularly affective mental health disorders. So, you know, you can certainly imagine that when people get angry, their sort of immune system, reticular endothelial system, their immune system gets activated, and you have all kinds of inflammatory markers, cytokines, chemokines, T cells, et cetera, all flying around. And, so it creates this state of inflammation that has other consequent effects.
Can I say, for the layman, your body gets out of whack, out of sync?
Sure.
Okay.
You know, the brain-body connection is another, you know, sort of metaphysical way, I guess, to say it. But, you know, they are connected. Right? The unhealthy person is more likely to be depressed, et cetera, and the depressed, et cetera, person is more likely to be physically unhealthy. And that's not just a coincidence.
Okay.
There is a direct relationship there. And it goes both directions on that, the relationship between those two.
Yeah, I was reading the other. Yeah, I was reading a book by a really good friend of mine. His name is Dr. Thomas Harbin. And he works a lot with our military members. He's actually out in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Great guy and psychiatrist. And I went out to – I read his book a while back because I was in preparation for writing my book. And I called him up one day and I asked, can I do an interview with you? And he said, sure. So I flew out to Fort Bragg and I met him. And he was talking about the correlation between depression and anger. And how the cycle can feed itself, and what that does, and it was pretty amazing. Do you see that that correlation?
Sort of the vicious cycle.
It is a vicious cycle. Yeah, very much.
You know, I completely see that and agree with it, and I think that even goes back to our discussion on motivation or finding your passion or those kinds of things. You know. Doing things, you know, there's a term called praxis. You'll start to feel how you act. So if you start to do things that you see motivated people do, get out of bed, get a job, go interact with people. Even if you don't feel like it, just start doing those things. Then you start feeling more like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's again the corollary to what you just said on the anger depression, which I completely agree with. It makes sense, and it's something we see.
Yeah.
You see it.
Yeah. I tell a story, and I've told this before, I think on the air, about I was on a late flight. I had been delayed like 2 days. The flight was delayed coming back into Atlanta. It was about 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, and I was in a very grumpy mood. I was just tired. I was fed up. All I wanted to do is get to my bed and get some sleep. And I was in a bad mood. And I said, you know what? I'm going to practice what I preach. And I chose going down the ramp before I hit the gate there. I am going to smile.
Uh-huh.
I said, I'm going to smile. And at first it was forced, man. It was like probably creepy to a lot of people in the TSA agents that are watching me. You know, I'm forced to smile. I said, no, I'm going to do this. And I started to smile. And then I started seeing other people's reactions around me as I was starting to smile. And I fed on that energy as well. And then I said, okay, this is cool. So I'm at the econ course. And if you've ever been to Atlanta Hartsfield, the econ course to baggage claim is 0.3 miles per terminal. I don't know if you knew that or not. So I walked almost like, you know, a mile and a half, 2 miles to the terminal. And I just kept smiling. And then by the time I got to baggage claim, my whole demeanor, my whole mood, the way I interact with people had totally changed because I chose to just smile. And it was interesting because I'd walk 100 yards, maybe less than that, and I'd stop and I'd turn around, and I would see people looking back at me who are smiling back, even the grumpy Gusses, and so it has a positive effect, and you can attract into your life, I believe, what you are, you know.
I agree, and yeah. I think this is part of what therapists do with people, is they'll say, I want you to do this, and you know, you just did some self-therapy. You know, I want you to do this, but then people will listen, but then not do it. They'll go to the piano lesson, but not practice the piano.
And so, it can happen, and I've had clients in my world that I've asked to do that, and then they come back and they start, oh shucks, you know, and they go it and so what happened goes it kind of works, but they don't always want to admit it, but you know it kind of works.
It's a good thing you walked though, because it doesn't work immediately.
No. Yeah. Yeah, and then I'm sure that TSA is going, who's this creepy guy, this 6'5" guy
put
walking
him on the
down?
Watch list.
He said, you know, why are they surrounding me? Okay, anger and domestic violence. I'm going to assume that you see the results or see that happening in our community. Can you speak on that as far as the impact you see and the cycle that takes place?
I don't consider myself a domestic violence expert, but I do see a lot of victims of domestic violence, or a lot of perpetrators of domestic violence.
Yeah.
And I guess the first thing is, and you know, you see it on the news all the time, is it's amazing how common it is, how rampant it is.
Yeah.
You look at the next door neighbor or the coworker or whoever and figure everything's fine and normal, and probably more often than not, it's not as peachy as you think it is. And
right.
So it's common, and of course it begets all the requisite consequences that you would expect, having, you know, with depression and anger and so forth. I guess, Jack, here's my thoughts on that. You know, we hear in the media and so forth all the time, ADD is overdiagnosed and bipolar is overdiagnosed and all these things that are overdiagnosed. I actually don't disagree with those, that there's many people that are diagnosed with these conditions that don't have them. I'd say a lot of them that... the treatment is still appropriate, whatever treatment they're getting. Maybe the label is wrong, but the treatment is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
But I would argue that most people with bipolar, most people with depression, most people with ADD, ADHD are actually undiagnosed and they're untreated.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can look up, and I hand out to patients this consequences of untreated ADHD, and you could really substitute bipolar in there or substitute, you know, chronic depression. And these consequences are all the same.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you don't get married to somebody with the plans of abusing them verbally, physically, or otherwise. Yet it happens a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I like the idea of premarital counseling.
Yeah.
And my gosh, can it really hurt anything? Have you ever met anybody who says, well, I should have never done that premarital counseling?
That really sucks, the things I know about you now.
Yeah.
But I'll marry you anyway. Yeah.
Right,
yeah,
right. Yeah, and, you know, you can do it with your, you know, the Myers-Briggs. You know, you can do that online. It's a nice, happy, feel-good personality test, but it still tells you,
So what the hell are you going to do with it now?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I have that thing. That's one of my pamphlet or brochure I could write instead of a book like you've managed to do, Jack, on things I never hear in practice. You know, I never, you know, in the office, I never hear anybody say, man, I wish I hadn't quit smoking.
Yeah,
you know, I wish I'd gotten worse grades. You know, those are things you don't hear.
I wish my life sucked more.
Right.
I totally agree with you. I've done a lot of research on it, and I am a victim of domestic violence, and as a son growing up, and I've written about it, and you always have, and this is why I asked you the question. I think you're the one of the most perfect guests to have on the show today, is that it stays hidden, and people will have a facade where on the outside everything looks nice and perfect and pretty. And they fill those voids and fill those gaps in their life, either with money, with cars, or other outside things to make their life look, everything's perfect. But really, there's a lot of sadness going on back there. And then the poor wife or even the husband has got to deal with that from day to day. Let's go back to the passion and that correlation. I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there's a correlation between knowing who you are in yourself and being able to deal with the anger and the domestic violence and the issues that come up, and knowing who you are from the core, from the inside out. And you say, thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, it sounds beautiful, and it makes complete complete sense. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that's rising above it, mm-hmm. you know, and probably making you a better person, you know, so to speak,
yeah.
Maybe a person who, you know, yourself better than the person who hasn't had to deal with the same thing and rise above it.
Yeah.
You know, I've been impressed with you since the day I met you.
Oh, thanks,
you know,
Barry.
I found out everything about you. I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
I haven't done a thing with my life.
Oh,
look at
that. I appreciate that. It was very
so,
kind.
So that's, you know, the idea that you would rise above it is the expected, not otherwise. But, you know, the more what I'm dealing with is the folks who come in who are the, like yourself, who are the victims of domestic violence, not as often the perpetrators.
How do you get them help, Barry?
So that's the tough thing, because there's a lot of times the things that you and I would sit there, or anybody would sit there and say, well, here's what they need to do, yet they don't do it.
Why don't they do it?
Because they're choosing the less hard thing to do. It's hard to stay in the circumstance, but it's even harder to leave it.
Yeah.
So it's the path of least resistance. So my, you know, and I told you I'm not an expert, but I like to give what I think is good advice, and most of these people have children. And my best advice I give them, and I would give it to anybody who's listening now who might be in those kinds of circumstances, most of them have children.
Yeah.
Well, if your own child was in that circumstance, what would you advise your child to do? How would you counsel and parent your child?
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what you need to do yourself.
For yourself.
Yeah. And to me, that's really the most light bulby way to approach it.
Mm-hmm.
What would you tell your kid to do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that operates under the assumption you love your child, but you know, I think most people do.
A technique that I like is write a letter to yourself. And said, you know, if you're going to write a letter to yourself, if you're going to write a letter to your 15-year-old self of what you know today, what would you tell yourself at 15 or 20? Say it's 20 years old. And I've had people refuse to do it because of the pain involved. Mm-hmm. And I've had people actually write that letter and then look at it and go, holy smokes. And then they make some pretty positive, drastic changes in their life because they've seen it now. They've seen that. And I totally agree with that. With what you said, Barry, is that you can you know, what would you advise your child if you were talking to them right now that was in a domestic abusive relationship? And you'd have a plan. Get out of it. You know, get the heck away from it.
Well, I like your technique. I think I'll use that.
Write that. You know, and another thing that I use is. What's your purpose and what's your mission? And one of the programs that I teach is the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People and some other programs. And also on my own, when I have clients, you ask them, I said, what's your purpose? What's your mission? What's your mission statement in life? What's your mission? He goes, well, I don't know. You know, I said, well, you know, McDonald's, Chick-fil-A, other great companies. I'm sure you guys have a mission statement. He said, they all have one. Why don't you develop one for yourself? Oh, that's going to be tough. I said, well, yeah. And, you know, you develop your own ethical, moral compass, maybe. And so when you're faced with those situations, do you have something you can pull out and go, that doesn't suit me, that's not who I am, thank you, have a nice day? And I always say, do the moonwalk and get out of the situation. And that would be a good tool. What does a good leader look like to you, a legacy leader look like?
Well, I'm going to cheat on this one.
Go ahead.
I think a good leader looks like what, at least in the book I'm going to reference, is referred to as a servant. My favorite book that I've read on leadership is called The Servant, and it's subtitled A Simple Story About the True Essence of Leadership, and it's so readable. It's by a guy named James Hunter. And again, one of the gentlemen I referred to before, Steve Plunkett, my life coach, turned me onto that many, many years ago. And it's a book I read, and then I immediately reread it and made a 12-page outline of it. And I'd rather reread that book every 6 months than get a different book every 6 months to read on leadership. I think it's wonderful in the way it illustrates what a leader looks like at home, at work, amongst your friends, wherever you are.
Can you give us some insight on the book?
Well, it's about things being about the other person. You know, how many times have you heard of people going on a mission trip and they came back and they're like, "I'm the one who gained from this, not the people I went to serve."
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I think that when you're acting as a servant leader, as the term is, that same thing happens. You serve others, and that's a model of leadership, but you're the one who gains the most from it, probably.
Tell me about stress and serving humanity.
So a simple question.
Yeah.
Stress and serving humanity.
I gave him a warning that we were going to, it's
I don't even know how to answer that one.
Yeah.
It's a good question, though. I think humanity, or at least it's stressful to be part of humanity.
Yeah.
Maybe how do you cope with that, or help people kind of cope with day-to-day life and the stresses that they,
I find that serving others and giving back to others does something for me there. And not that I want you to recognize it and go, oh, high five, fist bump. I go, no. Just something as simple as one of my favorite things to do in Starbucks, I should probably shouldn't say this now because people are going to start following me around, is I like to give back to the person that's coming in line and tell them I'll pay for their coffee and just walk away. I don't want anybody to say anything to me. Mm-hmm. I was in a Sam's Club, and I'd been a member for many, many years, and I renewed, and they gave me a gift card for X amount of dollars, and I refused it, and I said, take this and put it on the person's bill that's coming behind me. And the lady was just astonished I would do that. And I said, no, please don't make a big deal out of it. Just take this, leave it where it's at, and pass it on to the person behind me. Take care of the person behind me. So I think that serves me. I don't want to be selfish or anything. That just serves me, because if I can do something to somebody else, and it relieves stress for me. It does. And so I don't know.
Well, and then there's the other consequence.
And Barry's looking at me now. I know he's a mental health doc, whatever you think.
My other thought on that was the part missed there. What about the person that you said, hey, do this? The cashier.
Yeah, I said, would you mind?
You just modeled something to that cashier that was, they're like, wow.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it affected more than just the person behind you in line and the people that person spoke with, but that cashier and the others as well. And I think that's wonderful. But answering the question otherwise on stress and humanity, I think that a lot of the stresses come from not being honest with yourself, not being honest with other people. And, there's a few things I've tried to impart to my own children. Aren't you supposed to limit everything to three things? So they probably can only think of three things I've taught them. But one of the most common is just tell the truth.
Yeah.
Even when it's hard, just always default to telling the truth. And so that's what I try to do myself. Just tell the truth. And that is a stress reliever.
Yeah, it is.
Because again, another corollary, how do you feel when you lie or mislead in some way? I mean, you just feel awful, which starts that vicious cycle of feeling badly about yourself and acting the way people, you know, act in a contrary way with that, mm-hmm. and then feeling worse about yourself. And so just being honest, not yeah. meanly honest, but yeah. but being honest in all aspects of your life is a stress reliever.
Yeah. I like, yes. And I like that. If I can just switch gears real quick with you. you met me, and I'll do a full disclosure, and Barry's aware of this. And when I met Barry years ago, I was a very low point in my life. I was very sad, and I had just lost somebody that was very important to me. And I was searching. I needed somebody to help me out, and so I sought Barry out, and he was very, very helpful, and put me in the right direction, and because of that, that was the kickstart for me. And I don't think Barry knew this, but that was the kickstart for me, because I wanted to know what he knew. I wanted to know what was it about him that I was. That helped me, that he was put me on my way. So I read, I did a lot of research to start looking at myself, looking in the mirror, looking at things that were going on in my life. And I had a lot of anger. I was a very, very angry young man. And I had to go back and look and see where that anger was coming from. And it was from the loss of somebody I loved. It was from anger from my dad. And it was anger from things like, you know, the world needs to go my way, damn it, you know, and sometimes it doesn't happen. So I had to sit back and look at myself and ask myself the tough questions. Who am I? What's my purpose? What's my mission? And what's my legacy? And how can I give meaning to other people? So when I put the ego aside and put all that stuff aside and I looked at myself, it was a very transforming aha moment. And I said, you know what? I'm going to fix this. So I write about this in my book. And it's September 4th, 2007 was when I had my last drink. I said, nope, don't want this. Don't need it. Don't want this anymore. I'm going to face my issues and concerns. I'm going to face my problems head on like a warrior, the fighter that I was trained to be. Mm-hmm. And instead, I'm going to fix this and find out what the hell's going on here. And I'm going to find other ways of dealing with it. So I hired a great coach, somebody that, and a mutual friend of ours, who said that, coaching is healthy people helping healthy people. And I said, okay, so I consider myself, damn it, I'm healthy. I'm going to be healthy. And I hired Tracy Cleary down in Tampa, Florida, and we've been together now for 5 years, and we've been working together. And some of the things I've learned were so powerful and so unbelievable about the balance between your mental health, physical health, how you view and see the world, having a balance, a life-work balance, and that is the and having a mental, physical, social, emotional balance in your life can change your whole outlook and your whole view and your whole interaction on people and your health. And it was a very much an eye-opening experience for me as well. Facing the issues that I had to face, facing, the anger and where that came from and everything, and I decided to write about it. And so it's an opportunity for you to say thank you for that. Do you have any thoughts on that or
on a couple of things that you first off, not that this was necessarily your you said I stopped drinking, that drinking was at a harmful level, but
no.
But this you can add that to the list, Michael, of things that I've never heard anybody sit in the office and say, gosh, I wish I drank more alcohol. nobody says that.
Yeah.
And what people often are not aware of, because they'll drink because they're stressed, right?
Yeah.
Stress and depression and anger kind of go hand in hand.
Fill a void.
Yeah, well, alcohol, it relieves the stress, but it's a central nervous system depressant. It can cause depression or make depression worse. And I think that's not really as commonly known as I would guess.
Yeah.
So you know, for any you know, anybody who maybe is using alcohol to cope, you'll never sit there and say, "Gosh, I wish I drank more alcohol."
So yeah,
stopping.
Yeah,
it's that conundrum. If you need a drink, you shouldn't drink, and if you don't need one, why bother? Or something like that. So there's that. But you know, Jack, you had also at that time left the military.
I did.
You were a career military guy.
I was,
and
yeah.
One of the, when I see men that are having troubles, big troubles, you know, a lot of times it's that loss of a job. Now that's different. You left by choice.
Yeah, retired.
But still, you know, it had defined you, you know, in large part up to
yes.
that point in your life, and then it was just gone.
That's right. That's right. Thank you, Barry, for that. It's true. And a lot of our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines suffer from that today with a PTSD, and I come across a lot of them. They have been wired, thought, and they associate and link themselves to a position, a rank, or even the security clearance. And I find it's a quiet storm that's happening out there, and they don't want to lose their security clearance. They don't want to lose their top secret or secret security clearance. So they will refrain from coming to see you because if they are ever asked to go back and do a security clearance check, and they said, "Have you ever seen a mental health professional?" And they go, they're damned if they do and damned if they don't.
Right.
If they say they have, then they're going to say, "What was the doctor's name?" and blah, 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 because they're going to come talk to you and say, "Can this person, you know, is this person safe?" And if they don't want that to happen, they have that blemish, they'll say, "No, I haven't." But if they have an investigation and then later on find out, then they're sunk. They're done. And so it's a damned if you do and damned if you don't. So these young men and women live in that quiet desperation.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to get a handle on that in some way. And I'm thinking that it's gotten better over the years since I've retired to do that with all the stuff that's happening. We're losing about 22 soldiers a day to suicide. To suicide.
Wow.
And it doesn't talk about the social effect that it has on not only the family members, but the people, the second and third order effect of a soldier committing suicide.
You know, you're talking about it, the military is starting to get somewhat of a handle on it, but this same thing is happening with pilots, air traffic controllers, air marshals, because these people are, you know, something happens, they need treatment, they're grounded, they can't be on a scope, but, you know, as an air traffic controller, they can't work as an air marshal. So if they try to get whatever they're dealing with dealt with, a lot of them, especially if medication is a worthwhile thing, it can be, you know, at least temporarily, if not permanently, career halting.
Yeah,
and so it's a deterrent. Just live with your problem.
And look what that does for us.
It's terrible.
Yeah, it is. It's terrible. It's terrible. And I just made a conscious decision sitting in a bar in New Orleans. And I said, "You know what? I ain't doing this madness anymore. It's not serving me. I don't care. Okay, I'm going to go get some help. I'm going to go do what the hell I got to do to get out of it." And I did. And I have a lot of great things. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to spit in the microphone there, but you know, a lot of
I'll
great
clean it later.
Yeah,
it's okay. Thanks.
A lot of great things have happened, and the book is coming out, and it'll be out August 1st. It's The Other Side of Anger: A Son's Search for Peace. And then I've been picked up. A couple of folks have asked me to do a lot of private coaching and counseling with them, which I am not a licensed therapist or a licensed counselor. I am a certified by the State of Georgia life coach, strategic planner. There you go. That works for me. And so hey, I got to ask you, Barry, what's your theme song? So if they say, "Hey, you know," and ladies and gentlemen, he just gave me one of those looks that people always give us in the studio whenever we ask those questions. I said, so Barry, you go back to the office, and I'm sure you've got some of your employees maybe listening right now, and you go back to the office and say, "Oh my gosh, Dr. Hall's coming. Here we go. We're going to play his song. We're going to play his theme music." All right, everybody. Barry, what would that be?
Oh. Yeah, I guess it depends if I'm alive or not. You know, you want to say also Sprock Zarathustra, right?
Listen, I've had a lot of people sitting in that chair, and some of them will try and tap dance, but we're going to hold you on to it. Come on, talk to us.
Well, okay. I hope that it would be the song, The Voice of Truth, Casting Crowns, I believe.
Oh, yeah, Casting Crowns.
I love that song.
Okay.
I was joking with the Also Sprach Zarathustra. Only Elvis gets that one, I guess, you know. Or when I die, maybe I can have that one. Now, a song I really enjoy, but this is not my theme song.
We'll edit that. Go ahead, Barry. Share with us.
Don't you love that song, Sinner Man?
Sinner Man.
Yeah.
Talk to me. Sing a couple of bars, Mike. Go ahead.
Oh, I don't even know. I don't know. I would. I would totally. I'd tune up the pipes for you. But.
Okay. Okay.
Sinner Man. Who is that? Nina Simone.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. 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 I love seeing Nina Simone.
I think there's a generation gap in this room.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Yes. Today, Mike, you're an outsider.
No. Wait a minute. That song got new life on The Blacklist. Do you watch that?
I don't.
Sorry. Oh, gosh. Yeah.
You're just
Mike, I'm useless. Why am I even here?
Mike, you're the youngest. You're the youngest person in the studio, and you're not getting that. What's
I know. Mm-hmm. I said I watch TV. Mm-hmm. That's what excuse I'm rolling with on this one, though.
That's a good one. I actually like that one. Yeah.
So, how about Barry? A movie. Tell me about a movie that your favorite movie or something that defines you. A movie.
Favorite and defines me could be different things. I don't. I'll leave that up to my wife and kids to tell me what defines me.
And Barry's very analytical, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. He's very left brain.
Extremely.
So we'll play along. So Barry, whichever one suits you, which one would you like to tell us about?
Oh, well, the movie, it feeds right off of Voice of Truth, the movie Facing the Giants.
Oh, good choice.
You know that one.
I do
okay,
know that one.
Good.
Good choice. I like that. I like that as well. And mine still, I still dig Caddyshack,
I do like that.
But also one of my favorite is actually spiritually is I like the Da Vinci Code.
Oh, good call.
Yeah, the Da Vinci Code. And I'll tell you my favorite part of the Da Vinci Code is that, have you both seen it?
Yes.
Da Vinci Code. I like the Da Vinci Code because the passion, the very end, the last 10 minutes, when Tom Hanks discovers what he discovered in the movie. I don't want to get away to people that aren't, the answer.
They haven't seen it by now.
Yeah, okay. So when they discovered where they believe Mary Magdalene was buried, and he went to that spot, and then he had all the answers of the universe, and he was the only person, and then the music and the energy behind that, knowing what you know, and your center of your peace of who you are as a man and what your purpose is in life, that rocks. And that was I would go back and play that last 10 minutes 100 times just to watch that and Tom Hanks, and the movie in the Da Vinci Code when he found the final answers. So, ladies and gentlemen, looking at the clock, we got about 3 minutes to go here, and Barry. How can we find you? How can we locate you? Folks that have been listening to the show that wanted to come see you, talk to you.
I'm not out there on a lot of social media. I've thought I should. I have a Facebook page, personal, that I accidentally reactivated recently. I pushed the wrong button or something.
Okay.
This is terrible, Jack. My approach has generally been, I don't try to advertise or get out there or something like that, because the people that come and see me, I want them to come see me because they know somebody who saw me who had a good experience, who has confidence, or that they're referred by a physician who knows me, trusts me, mm-hmm. and thinks I do a good job. So I guess that's the way I like to have the patients arrive at my door with the confidence of others and consequently their own confidence initially. Otherwise, I do have I suppose technically two websites. One is anewstartmedicalcenter. com, and I think also anewstartmedical.com if you have weaker typing fingers. And Peach State TMS, that's transcranial magnetic stimulation. It's part of my fascination with the mental health field is where it's going in terms of looking more at things like genetics and inflammation and neuromodulation as opposed to drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And transcranial magnetic stimulation is a safe and effective neuromodulation technique. Think about it as a ECT without the invasiveness and without the baggage.
Yeah.
And it's done easily in the office. So That's what Peach State TMS is. It's the TMS thing, part of the neuromodulation tool that I use in the office for treating primarily depression. But a New Start Medical Center .com is the website.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. And ladies and gentlemen, once again, as we get ready close to finish up the hour, I would like to thank everybody who's been a big support for me, who's been pushing me, who's been and helping me, and been motivators and with great ideas. And I'd like to thank the fine, great folks at Radio X and Brother Mike here. And ladies and gentlemen, before I close out, I'd like to tell everybody that the 1st of August, my new book will be coming out. My only book will be coming out. It's called The Other Side of Anger, A Son's Search for Peace. It's about my journey through my life and dealing with anger, sadness, and depression on my father's part and family, and what we did to get past it and get over that, and what we techniques solutions that you can use as well. So please don't hide. If you have an issue, concern, or a problem, find a mental health professional, find a doctor, find somebody, get help. And I love you all, and thank you all for your support over these last 6 months. And ladies and gentlemen, we are out of here.